So I'm reflecting on this evening, there's really two themes. One is the time of the winter solstice, and the second is awakening. We could say that they're related because the light is awakening at this time. And in so many cultures, so there's this mystery of the time of greatest darkness coming to the shift. Literally, the day of the solstice, which is Tuesday. The literal meaning of solstice is the sun standing still, the moment of transition. And whether that's an actual moment, hard to tell. It's probably just, it's like in our practice, what does it mean to be in the moment? Is there really a moment? I won't follow that question this evening, maybe another time. But just to take this time, which in so many cultures, is a time for reflection, remembrance of the most important things in life. In many cultures, it's a time of purification, of reorientation towards what's most significant. Again, following the example of the earth. There's a poem I like really about this time, John Updike. The days are short, the sun a spark, hung thin between the dark and dark. So we've already had Hanukkah, which is about this mystery of how there was still light, even though there was only enough oil for one night, but it lasted for 8 nights. Has anyone been to Stonehenge? Stonehenge, the primary stones are oriented to create a line pointing to the sunrise on winter solstice and the sunset. And all the gatherings there are, again, in orientation to this mystery. The Celtic tradition had this period is very special, and it's a time of spiritual transformation. Very in their tradition, very much related to the earth. There are 4 weeks of Advent. The first week is the Advent of the minerals, the stones, and the mountains. The second is the Advent of the plants, of everything growing. And people put fresh greens in their homes. The third week is the advent of the animals. The fourth week is the advent of the angels. And then the most important festival in China at this time is called Dongji. And it's really a time to reflect on the mystery of the balance of light and dark, the yin and the yang. People come together, it's a special family time. And so in our culture, there often is a great deal of craziness. Shopping and somewhat frenetic time around the holidays, New Year's, driving and so forth. And I think my invitation for myself and for all of us is to consider really having this time be a time of stopping and seeing what comes next. I really love the image of the light coming, and to have that opportunity to look deeply, maybe take a few days. You know, for me, I've not scheduled anything for a week and really want to have that time be one of deepening. And I just taught through yesterday and today a two-day retreat on really deepening in wisdom and kindness at the time of the solstice. Taught it with Sylvia and Corey. Was there anyone else on that? Bowman and was on that retreat. And so we can stop and just see what's there. And we do so partly with cognizance of the challenges of our time, which are immense, right? And we can stop and look deeply and ask, not just on the personal level, but on the collective level, how can I contribute to the transformations that are necessary? Of course, the climate crisis, another meeting of the nations a little while ago. The results were not dramatic for that meeting. It seems to take, or it seems to be requiring, an upswelling of people, particularly young people. I read something just this morning from a person in his 20s who was reflecting on his sadness and saying, my future has no future. And I hear that, actually. I was talking with a friend 2 or 3 days ago who lives in Israel, who's been doing practices of the kind developed originally by Joanna Macy with young people around climate issues. And she reported to me hearing that same kind of despair from young people, understandably. Right. And so the time of the winter solstice can be a time where we are quiet, we stop, we are with the darkness and the coming light. You know, amazing to come towards St. Luke's and see the moon, right? Wasn't that something? Still there. As far as I know, I haven't checked recently, but moons are impermanent like everything else, but not that impermanent. It reminds me of a poem that Gary Snyder wrote based on a conversation with fellow poet Lou Welch, where they were like around a campfire and Lou Welch said to Gary Snyder, what do you think the rocks think about the trees? Gary Snyder said, what you getting at, Lou? He says, well, you know, for the rocks, the trees are just passing through. But things are changing, but there's this call, really, where we have political polarization, you know, democracy in great danger. We have one political party which seems to be turning its back on democracy in multiple ways. What do we do about that? How do we respond? And the problems of inequality and poverty and so forth, they're immense. So how, you know, for a week or some time and become quiet enough to see my orientation, to see what calls me personally and what calls me in terms of the response to the world. That's what I'm inviting of myself, inviting of each of us. Can I take some time to be quiet, maybe meditate half the day, take walks, see what calls us? Sometimes what calls us is difficult. Maybe there's some part of one's own life that one has to bring into greater balance. Being with the darkness can be a powerful reminder. Where is there darkness in my life? How can I respond to the darkness and invite the light, both in myself and in the world? And then the second theme that's really related is awakening, which is, we know, sometimes talked about very directly in terms of light, right? Sometimes we use enlightenment as a synonym of awakening, right? And the process of awakening brings light in different ways, light to see clearly, sometimes literal light in our minds, the shining of our minds. You know, as the Buddha said, the mind is luminous, but it gets covered over. Or Achan Man from the Thai forest tradition, this mind is radiant, but covered over by what he called passing corruptions. So we've looked in the last few times that I've been here at awakening in quite a number of different ways. We've looked at the traditional sense of awakening, sometimes understood as the development of the factors of awakening. And we've looked at the way that awakening sometimes is talked about as a kind of awareness that's goes beyond the usual awareness, that we can awaken to the fundamental unity of all life and all being. And that's an experience named by the Buddha, not so central to the teaching, but we looked at that. How does that appear for the Buddha? Call it awakened awareness. The Buddha talked about there being a potential in our being of an awareness which is, in his language, signless, boundless, and all luminous. Would you like to hang out there? Anyone? Okay. We're on. Okay. And so we looked at how that manifests in teachings of the Buddha, the passages. It's not at the center of the teachings, but it's there. And that kind of awareness, many believe, is what he was getting at talking about Nibbana. Again, a kind of boundless awareness without boundaries, without the boundaries of self and other, without the boundary of inner and outer. Accessible right now. And okay, maybe Maybe that could be a topic for the day long. Awakened awareness. And you vote through that. We were trying to think of a topic for the day long in May, not January. So, and we also covered how the sense of awakened awareness is there in the Thai forest tradition. One of the direct lineages connected with insight meditation in the West. Therefore, the founder, or one really person who founded Achan Man, as I mentioned, therefore Achan Cha, the teacher of Jack Kornfield and Sinisara Kittasaro, other teachers who are connected with Spirit Rock and other places. And I've mentioned how I studied briefly with Achan Cha, got to meet him, study with him, and how he talked about how there's this old mind, this original mind, which has these qualities of radiance and beauty. And I also think the last time I was here in person, that was the time I believe I talked about the sense of contemporary awakening and what the path might look like, really, to come to full working through of all of our confusion, all of our conditioning. And then I suggested that we'd want to have a map of practice that includes how do we work through our gender conditioning, our racial conditioning, our conditioning about other social dimensions, about age or sexual orientation. How do we work through what we might call the psychological material that all of us have, typically from childhood, that's still there? You know, I work with people in their 70s who were working through stuff that was developed when they were 5 years old. Anyone still have stuff that's an old pattern? Right. How do we have a path, a practice that brings in traditional awakening to this luminous, boundless, signless awareness and integrate that with going through what we might call our stuff? That's what I explored last time. And because our stuff makes it harder to be with that awakened awareness. We can't really stabilize it when we have that stuff still present. So in that sense, it's a very exciting time. I see a whole new sense of awakening and the thing coming into being. In other words, our notions of awakening evolve. Isn't that interesting? Awakening evolves in its nature and in the practices. And so one way that we can really focus on awakening is through the traditional teachings. What I suggested last time is that the traditional sense of awakening has to be complemented by these new pathways of working through conditioning and confusion and habitual tendencies. But the traditional practices are still very powerful and they really, really overlap. And so one model, which I want to talk about the rest, is the one I've looked at some, the teaching of the factors of awakening, which I named in the meditation, the factors of mindfulness, which is usually set off by itself, and then linked with three energizing factors and three stabilizing factors. The energizing factors are inquiry or investigation, developing more energy, and developing joy and rapture. PT is the word. And then the stabilizing factors are tranquility and concentration and equanimity. And what I wanted to look at for the rest of the time is how do we develop these in our formal meditation and in our daily lives? Because this can really be a curriculum. If you want to you know, take 3 days, take a week, and go deeply and practice. One way would be to really deepen the awakened qualities as well as give open time. And I've been reflecting on this, and I was, reflecting, and I think I'll mention three factors and point to how we would develop them, both in formal meditation and in daily life. And I'm particularly interested in how we do this in daily life. How do you develop mindfulness in daily life? Well, we've probably looked at that a lot. You know, one of the kind of funny things that happened when I was doing that book, The Engaged Spiritual Life, I just wrote all that came to me. And my original manuscript that I gave to the publisher was probably 75% over the limit. I think I had 500 manuscript pages. And I know that they could only fit 300. And one of the things that I had in it was I had a whole section on 60 ways of developing mindfulness in daily life. That got cut. But I still have it. And I've actually been talking. One of my students suggested connecting with a cartoonist and having a very simple book, which maybe I go from 60 to 100 or 108 or whatever, and have 100 ways of developing mindfulness, have each one of them one page, and then have a cartoon illustrating how to do it. Well, you like the idea? More of you would buy it than my book, The Engaged Spiritual Life. Anyway, perhaps, but anyway, but I was looking at that because it's, and this is something we can look at. So, I brought in that list and I look at it, said, first of all, in formal meditation, we can work with the instructions from the text. We could really cultivate mindfulness of the body. Be mindful of the body continually in one's formal meditation. One practice which I did for about 4 years was mindfulness of the whole body. It's a beautiful practice to do in formal practice because it transfers into daily life. I think mindfulness of the body is the secret link to have mindfulness come alive in daily life, right? So especially in a mental electronic culture, right? Where we're very in mental realm, automatic realm. Mindfulness of body is so crucial. I often mention that, when I was first coming to do Dharma talks, my kind of mentor and teacher at that time, John Travis, he said, plan your talks ahead. Be mindful of your body and be in your heart and let your thoughts self-organize. Interesting formula for life, right? So the mindfulness body is so cool. You could do it in formal meditation and then bring it into daily life in all sorts of ways. Say, I will cultivate mindfulness of the body in the kitchen. I will take walks every day and do mindfulness of the body practice. Mindfulness of the body while shopping, right? Commit to that for a week. Mindfulness will come alive, or have a ritual where you, do mindfulness in a particular activity. So I'm going to mention a bunch of things. Think, see if one or two of them resonate for you. So maybe I'll read from the list. Every morning, be mindfully present to the natural world for some time. You might take a walk every morning or sit and stand or walk for the sunrise. Choose a thread of awareness which you can continually find after being distracted, like the breath or sensation, some part of the body, the hands, feet, the whole body. During the day, no matter what you are doing, come back to that constant thread. take short breaks for 5 or 10 minutes for mindfulness during the day. Sit 5 minutes before every meal. Cultivate mindfulness. Practice mindfulness during the meal. So those are 5 or so. I won't mention the other 55. But the point is, we can really say, you know, and I think it requires support, doesn't it? You know, can I do this with another person where we support each other? You know, that would be wonderful, because how many people find you can have an intention and it's hard to keep just by yourself, right? So this is where community comes in. How to do that? I wanted to mention another factor. Concentration could be something we develop in formal meditation, daily life. In formal meditation, pretty obvious. We know all sorts of ways to concentrate. Just stay with the breath, keep coming back. Kind of work with developing concentration, just focusing on one's anchor, on the breath, on one's body. Do that in formal meditation. Practice concentration for a week. Again, what I'm suggesting is, how do you develop the factors of awakening, maybe during this winter solstice time? How to do that both in formal meditation and daily life? You know, one of the things I love about working with people one-on-one is that very often a certain number of people like to take a focus for a whole month. And we typically meet once a month. And then people focus for a whole month on a given theme, right? And it could be concentration. It could be generosity. It's a beautiful way to practice. And it really often takes the support either of a mentor or of a friend. But I'm really suggesting things that might spark your imagination. Yeah, I want to deepen my practice. Let me take the winter solstice time as a way to come into myself and say, let me deepen in that way for the next period of time. Let me do it with the support of this friend. Commit to that. Let's see what supports that. You know, and we can also develop in concentration in just in daily life flow. What would it mean? It might mean, let me for 1 week not multitask. Is anyone here multitask? Looks like almost no one. Unless you were multitasking when I asked that question and didn't get the question. Could be. You could have an intention not to multitask for a week. See what that's like. What do you learn? Very interesting, isn't it? Or just say, I will have really focused concentration every time I cook, every time I prepare a meal, or during some other activity. And so we can actually, you know, unify for a week, for a month, the development of concentration in formal practice with the development, as it were, off the cushion. You know, and for me, that, you know, this question of how do I deepen, intensify my practice in daily life is still really such a key question for all of us. How do I have the support to do that? It's not easy, right? How do I find my way, you know? I was talking with one of my students, I think just 2 days ago, and she was saying, you know, I'm a little bit tired of just going to retreats, having deep experiences, and then coming back, and my daily life is on a different level. How do I have my daily life approach the level of retreats? Not an easy question to answer, right? How many can relate to that one? So it's something we long for, and maybe we need to invent different forms of community or have more connective community. Something like that, I think, is necessary. How do we do that? You know, Zoom is an interesting feature. We could, you know, there are electronics can be part of the support. And then last quality I wanted to name, and then we can talk together, is equanimity. It's the last one. And how do I develop equanimity? It's really a fruit in formal practice, just of staying with the practice. I like to think that we particularly develop equanimity by being with everything that challenges our ability to be present, that makes it hard to be present. I develop equanimity by seeing what takes me out of equanimity, what gets me confused, or my getting caught up in anger or being judgmental or having uncomfortable body sensations. You know, we try to be mindful or aware of those. And in the process, we learn better how to be with the difficult experiences. So one very clear way to develop more equanimity is to be with what takes us off balance. You know, the model that's probably the best, the kind of the easiest to remember, is that it's the teaching of the eight worldly winds. Remember that? I think I've taught about that here. The eight worldly winds that we just say, put the names of the eight worldly winds on your refrigerator. Practice equanimity for a week by seeing when they come up: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame. Track those when they come up. Those are what knock us off center. And so let me finish with that. And just before we talk together, let me invite everyone just to reflect on: do you feel called at the time of the winter solstice, or maybe a little bit after, to have some time where you are quiet, where you make time and space for going more deeply, seeing what comes next for you individually and in terms of your contributions to our world? What calls you? And can also add, are there any particular practices which call you? So just reflect for a minute or so. What comes to you in response to those questions? So thank you, and let's open things up, and can be any sharing or questions, whether on Zoom or in the hall here. And on this theme, Bill, this can actually be the title of the talk: Awakening at the Winter Solstice. How's that sound? Any sharing? Okay, looks like we have one from Isabel, and then in the back. Yeah, you remind me your name.
Rick.
Okay. Yeah. So Isabel, please. And will this come through?
Oh yeah. Can you hear me?
Okay, hold on, Isabel. Yeah, I have to have my volume. Is that the only way it'll come through?
To the right. One more to the right. There you go. And then do that a few times. And shoot.
Okay, Isabel, please.
Thank you, Donald. I actually had my hand up because earlier you asked if anybody multitasked, and I am guilty as charged, and it's a big problem for me. Although, you know, my practice helps me to not do it as much. My mindfulness practice, definitely. So I didn't really, but I do love the eight factors, and I love the idea of using the winter solstice for awakening. And for me, I've studied the eight factors a lot. And so oftentimes I'll just see when I'm really investigating, and I'll see when I, you know, when I feel any one of them, it makes me feel so good when I see them in my life, not even just in my practice, but in daily life. Then I just feel like I'm making progress, because I know that they are the sign that you're actually, the practice is working. So, so definitely I'm going to take advantage of you saying to, you know, this is a good way to practice. So thank you.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Isabel. And yeah, and particularly I wanted to really take advantage of this time of the winter solstice, because it's can be such a natural time for being less busy. Yeah. And the seven factors are, you know, of awakening are a guide. They can be really a wonderful guide for our practice. One could take one factor a week or one factor for a month. You know, I mean, some people work quite well with structure like that. You know? And then I guess the other thing would be just to see, is there one form of multitasking which you could let go of, at least for a week? I think that I always find if one wants to change a habit, not so skillful usually to say, I will just drop this habit forever. That usually doesn't work, but to say, for a week, okay, I'll do it. Okay. Thanks, Isabel. And we can go to Rick, who is here. Yeah, put it real close, because I'm maybe having some trouble hearing. But I'll repeat the question also, or the comment. So far, yeah.
Yes, I was thinking about the multitasking.
Oh, yeah.
I could not quite hear what you were saying, but I can't multitask very well at all. Nor can I concentrate. When I try to concentrate, the multi things come in, and when I try and multitask, I wind up concentrating on one thing. I live in a world of chaos in between the two. And so I think I'm probably better off trying to concentrate on one thing at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the Buddha in the figure mindfulness can accomplish the multitasking at the same time and be aware of the action.
Yeah, I think I'll repeat the question for the sake of people who are online. Rick was saying that he doesn't really multitask well and doesn't concentrate well either. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that so it was really so that's great about multitasking, not well. I think that's very important.
I don't think I can do it at all.
Right, and so
one thing, then put it to the other.
Yeah, so I think what you're suggesting as a model is just do one thing, then another. And that's really what's being suggested. You know, to one thing, focus on it, switch to the next. Such a simple idea, but we often do multiple things. You know, whether it's even just to explore how we do it. I was exploring. I like to, you know, in the past, I've sometimes liked to listen to the radio when I'm preparing a meal. And recently I said, let me just do one thing. Yeah. Thanks, Rick. Anyone else inspired to take some time at the winter solstice? Wants to share what you might do? Yeah, please. It's okay for me.
Okay. I don't think you'd be able to hear me otherwise. I really like the idea of using the worldly winds.
Yeah.
But I just have to say that I probably would just be examining. I like the equanimity piece, but I just have to say that I'd much be more likely to just stick with what I'm actually feeling. And then maybe considering equanimity if I'm getting out of balance. But, but you know, just to get the same kind of like peacefulness around whether I was gaining or losing would be really tricky.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alice. Really, the question was about developing equanimity through working with the eight worldly winds. Again, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame. And was really bringing up that, correct me if I didn't quite get it, but that it's, you would really prefer really just to stay with what's coming up. And I think I went over it a little bit too quickly, because the practice that we would do with the eight worldly winds isn't just sort of seeing them and getting rid of them and so I can be equanimous. It's not really, it's actually more being present with them, bringing mindfulness to them, learning about them, not trying to get rid of them. And so something strongly pleasurable is there. Let me be attentive. You know, maybe really good pumpkin pie during a holiday gathering. Oh, this is really, really pleasant. Oh, so it's not about get rid of the sense of pleasant, get rid of the pumpkin pie, be equanimous. No. No, it'd be more like just explore. This is, you know, where it really merges with investigation. What's my experience of pleasure like? Can I really taste the pie, or is my mind going to the second piece, which I have sometimes seen in myself, these dynamics? Has anyone else noted something like that? It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, one of the things that I first experienced during retreats, when I first was doing retreats, was that I was actually tasting food in a vastly fuller way than I had ever tasted food. That normally, I mean, partly meals are social, so we're not always tasting because we're focusing on the conversation. But at other times, even, you know, we might be doing something else, but rarely 100% of attention on how pleasant the food is. And I remember some of the early retreats, I would eat really, really slowly. I would have 10 raisins in half an hour and really taste them and be with the pleasure. Not a typical experience. So same thing, if something's painful, be with it. Watch the tendencies of the mind to want to push it away, get rid of it. That's how, and out of that equanimity develops. But it's not about, you know, saying, let me be equanimous with this. So thank you so much for the question. It's really about being present, looking at the dynamics of the mind. When I, you know, when someone praises me, what goes on? Someone criticizes me. Let me notice what that's like. Someone does it publicly. Let me notice. It's hard, but can I notice what's that like? What comes up? What, you know, in this case, maybe childhood experience comes up. You know, I didn't do a good job. I won't get praised by my parents, even though neither of them is alive. Well, yeah. Thanks. Thanks. That's a good, important question. Yeah. Maybe time for one more. Yeah, you can bring down your mask if you'd like.
Yeah, I was thinking about for me, I think.
A little closer, Emma.
I think for me, the multitasking comes in when I'm in one of the states of discomfort.
Yeah, yeah.
Overwhelm. There's this tendency to, I don't know if it's like reaching for achievement or some finish line. But the multitasking, it gets. gets really motivated to come in from that place.
Yeah.
Versus when I'm really attending to my practice and I'm really attending to myself, and then in those times I'm facing all my tasks as much of a cleaning.
Yeah. Really yeah. And remind me of your name?
Sheila.
Sheila?
Sheila.
Sheila, yeah. Yeah, so Sheila was saying that she's really investigated multitasking, which I love the quality of inquiry here, right? What is multitasking about? And for Sheila, it was about where you're saying that there was some, say it again, some...
There's a quality inside of busyness and not stillness and not attending to self. In that place, there's a like there's sort of a desire for multitasking, and I can only imagine maybe it's
yeah
has a goal in mind or it has
yeah. Mind. So in the multitasking, sometimes. Related to lack of inner stillness or quiet, but then also wanting something could be achievements. When I've looked into multitasking, when I stopped it, it was like listening to the radio. There's kind of a sense of connection where I'm connecting to the world, right? It's not necessarily negative, right? But very interesting to like investigate multitasking. What's that about? No one's given a Dharma talk on multitasking. You know, we can explore, you know, what this is. Write an article in the Buddhist Journal on multitasking. Anyway, thank you, Shira.
Thank you.